This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about The Boss Baby, Ghost in the Shell, The Zookeeper's Wife, The Black Coat's Daughter, and Land of Mine. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and the home cinema roundup with a spotlight on Why Him and an interview with its director, John Hamburg. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First piece of news, I just wanted to welcome a new affiliate. That is WVTS-AM in Charleston, West Virginia, News Talk 1240. I was just recently in Charleston, had dinner there at this Mexican restaurant called La Carreta, I think is what it was called. I was on my way down to Florida, actually, to take a cruise, and my wife and I stopped in Charleston. It's a real pretty city. I mean, it's neat when you drive through because they got the big capital there. We've driven through it there. We usually end up driving through during a snowstorm, which that freeway, 77, going through, covered in a foot of snow, is a little bit dangerous. Fortunately, no one else was on the road at that time. That was a couple years ago. But yeah, this year, I actually just had a chance to stop in Charleston. So welcome, Charleston, to the Fat Guys Nation. The next piece of news, which is not about me, but more about the movies, that is that Joss Whedon is reportedly being courted to do a standalone Batgirl movie, which is interesting because he did so great with Avengers, not so great with Avengers Age of Ultron. It's still a decent movie, but he really shows that he knows what he's doing when it comes to superhero characters. I'm curious to see what he does with Batgirl, mainly because the DC Cinematic Universe is so heavy and dour and dark, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But it's just nice to see a director who might give it a little bit more of an optimistic spin, even though Joss Whedon still likes to stick the knife in and turn it now and then. Now, speaking of DC Cinematic Universe, the Justice League had some stuff come out at CinemaCon, and the rumor right now is that it's 170 minutes long, which is something like 20 minutes longer than Batman versus Superman, although that doesn't really mean anything. I mean, the running time currently in the last weekend of March, first weekend of April, that's really not a reliable time frame. The movie doesn't come out until November, so there's plenty of time. I'm sure it's like either an assembled cut or they still need to add some stuff and trim some scenes out. That's probably the full rough assemble before they get feedback and that sort of thing. I imagine it's not going to be that long. That's, you know, but then again, we've had rumors where Michael Bay movies have said, oh, they're going to be pushing 3 hours, and then they were. And so I guess that's not an unthinkable thing to see happen with a movie. Another piece of news, which is interesting in terms of development, Jordan Peele, who of course made a real splash with Get Out earlier this year, he is apparently being courted for the live-action remake of Akira, which has been in the works for decades, really. And that's interesting news coming out this weekend when you had Ghost in the Shell is one of the movies that's getting all complaints about whitewashing and that sort of thing. And I'll address that actually when we talk about Ghost in the Shell later in the show. But I'd be curious to see how he would approach Akira. Although, I mean, this is just a rumor at this point. I don't even know if it's even going to be a signed deal. That would be a huge leap going from just a minimalistic, small, low-budget horror film to what would effectively be a big blockbuster, $150 million at least movie like Akira. I mean, that movie would need a lot of special effects. And speaking of special effects, there's the Venom movie that's in development that's being rumored as saying it's not going to be part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but it might get an R rating. So Sony might be trying to swerve their way into Logan Deadpool territory with a little bit more of a grown-up, scary, horror-centric, violent superhero. And then finally, the last piece of news that I found interesting is the Oscars, the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences, has made a decision about Price Waterhouse, which is, of course, the accounting firm that does all the counting of the ballots and is the ones responsible for the ginormous gaffe, envelope gate, as we like to call it, by ultimately giving the wrong envelope and paving the way for Faye Dunaway to announce the wrong Best Picture winner. Apparently, the Oscars is going to keep using them. They had a dressing down and they looked at all this. But the one rule that they're going to install is they're going to say you're not allowed to have phones backstage. The Pricewaterhouse accountants aren't allowed to have phones because supposedly he was taking pictures. The guy who was responsible for the wrong envelope, he was taking pictures and Instagramming like Emma Stone backstage when he should have been keeping straight which envelope he handed to the talent going on stage. So, if you're all worried that Pricewaterhouse is going to be kicked to the curb, they're not. They've been doing Oscars for decades and they'll continue to do them. But I think they're closing up a couple loopholes. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll right into the trailer park. The first one is actually one that I've seen cause a lot of buzz just this week, especially for horror fans and in the horror community, and that is Stephen King's It. The remake, the big screen remake, they did a TV movie back in the 1990, I think it was, with Tim Curry playing Pennywise the Clown. Well, they've got the remake, and it's coming out September 8th, and here is the new trailer.
Derry's not like any town I've ever been in before. People die or disappear 6 times the national average, and that's just grown-ups. Kids are worse. Way, way worse.
We all float down here.
I saw something. There was this...
a clown. Yeah, I saw him too.
Look. It's all connected by the sewers. That's where it lives.
I read It when I was in college, and I thought it was a fantastic book. It's long and it's bloated. It really doesn't need to be like 1,100 pages or however long it is. He probably could have cut a good 200, 300 pages out of it, but it's still one of his masterworks, along with like The Stand, which is this multi-character, well-developed, very dense and thick and story. It is a little bit more of an intimate story. It's more about just a group of kids in a town as opposed to The Stand, which is this global catastrophe. But it's an effective book. And Tim Curry was great as Pennywise, and Tommy Lee Wallace, who directed it, who also directed Halloween 3, which is one of the fun guilty pleasures that I have. The 1990 TV movie aspect of it was a little bit rough. I'm looking forward to an R-rated big screen version of the film. It actually looks effectively creepy. I'm really looking forward to this one now. I was very trepidatious earlier, but I'm very curious now. The next one I want to talk about is The Justice League, which opens on November 17th.
He said the Age of Heroes would never come again.
Has to.
What are your superpowers again?
I'm rich.
One thing I can tell you is you got to be free.
My turn.
Come together. Right now.
Shall we?
It's good to see you playing well with others again.
Just like a bat. I dig it.
Maybe temporary.
Yeah!
I have to say, I am not impressed with this trailer. This trailer looks like they're trying to follow the pattern of Suicide Squad, where they say, okay, let's just put a hodgepodge of stuff together and cut it to some really cool music. It still looks like it's overly dark. It's trying to almost be too whimsical and sardonically sarcastic. And I really don't know how Aquaman fits into all this. It doesn't set it up very well. This is not a very good trailer. Any confidence I had from the first one is kind of vaporized with this one. We'll see. I mean, we still got, 8 months to go until this movie comes out? So There's time. All right, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the zookeeper's wife and the black coat's daughter. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the first movie that's on the docket, and that is The Zookeeper's Wife. A husband and wife who run a zoo in Warsaw use it as cover to help Jews escape the ghetto after the Nazis invade Poland.
The country's completely overrun. They're forcing Jews out of their homes. They're taking us all to the ghetto. Thousands of people are dying. The littlest of children.
We have a room. We could hide them. Bring as many as you can.
I remember when this movie was first advertised, sometime in the fall of last year was, I think, when it kind of hit my radar. And first of all, I'm going to say, and people know that I'm not a huge fan of Jessica Chastain. I know that everybody loves Jessica Chastain and she's the greatest actress ever. I'm not a big fan. To me, she's like Meryl Streep. I mean, Meryl Streep, I know, I get it. People love her. I've never been a big fan of Meryl Streep. I'm not excited to see her in a movie. And that's kind of the way I am with Jessica Chastain. Now, both of them are actually very good actors, and I've seen movies of them that I've liked. It's just that I don't always 100% love Jessica Chastain. But I remember seeing this and saying, oh, that's a vehicle for her, and it's a Holocaust pick. So, you know, of course, that always seemed to be the easy approach to award films. In fact, back in my filmmaking days, this guy was trying to get me to help him write a script. And it was funny because he was Jewish and he's like, you need to help me write this script about the Holocaust, because Holocaust movies always win awards. And I'm like, okay, that never came off the ground. But that's sort of the joke, you know, in Hollywood, especially it was, you know, 20, 30 years ago. But this felt like, you know, this is going to be a Jessica Chastain's award film. But then I found out that it was opening in the early spring. And I was like, well, that's odd. Usually this is the kind of movie you'd expect to see coming out October, November, December, ready for award season. And in a way, after seeing it, I'm kind of like, I'm surprised they didn't stick to that as a release schedule, because it certainly is an acting spotlight on Jessica Chastain, and she does a fine job. Yeah, her Polish accent is a little bit thick. I don't know how authentic it is, but it almost seems comical at times. But still, the movie itself is very, very good. And I mean, she's fine in the film. But the thing that I was most impressed about The Zookeeper's Wife was, like I said, there have been a lot of movies about the Holocaust. There's been a lot of movies about World War II. That's been a popular topic for, 70 years? You know, ever since the end of World War II, really. Or even during World War II, there were World War II movies made in World War II. It's been an easy go-to because you had very defined villains. You had the Nazis. It is easy to put Nazis as the bad guys in the movies. I mean, just look at any Indiana Jones film. So there have been so many World War II movies that you almost think, haven't they told all the stories there are? Because there are so many different aspects to World War II that have been covered, from the battlefield to behind the scenes to back home to, you know, even just recently we had Hacksaw Ridge. There was a World War II film that it was something that we hadn't seen. And so it's nice to see that there are still movies and stories that need to be told of people from World War II that people don't even know, that people aren't aware was a triumph for them. And this husband and wife from Poland, that was, I didn't know this thing existed. I mean, I, you know, everybody knew that there were people hiding Jews and other people wanted by the Nazi government, hiding them and trying to get them to safety. But I never heard about this zoo, and I think it's a fantastic story. And it's also tough to watch too, because, you know, it's World War II, and there's some pretty horrible things that happened, even when you were not on the battlefield, which they weren't. But it's a strong movie and a powerful movie and an emotional movie. And it does show the tenuous situation that a lot of these Jewish Poles were facing at the time, and the horrors that they never go to the death camps, but of course they're getting on the trains. And, I've seen the results of some of this. So this is, it's not overtly brutal. A lot of the really bad stuff happens off screen or is implied is going to happen. But the fact that we know this from history and just from seeing other films and reading about it and studying it in school, we know what's going to happen. And it uses that knowledge that we have to great effect in this film. But ultimately, it's at times an unpredictable film that you don't know what's going to happen, because this is not the most well-known story that came out of World War II. So I'm going to have to say The Zookeeper's Wife rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Black Coat's Daughter. Two girls left over break in a boarding school experience eerie events while another mysterious girl makes her way from a mental hospital to the town.
Hey, Dad, just calling to see where you and Mom are, if you're coming.
Worst case, they come on Friday and everyone goes home and has a really nice break. After all, we can't let you live here.
But you know about the sisters, don't you? They worship the devil.
Is there something wrong?
This is a smaller release, and if it's not in your local town, you can get it on demand through DirecTV. But there are some theaters, like in theater from my hometown, the Gateway Film Centers is opening it. Now, it's a thriller, it's a horror story, but it's a very subtle, low-key, slow-burn horror story. I mean, it's not like Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Freddy Krueger film. It is as much a psychological thriller as it is just an overt possible possession and Satanism and demons. But those are, I mean, it's not like The Exorcist. It's not right there on the surface. It exists in the shadows, and it's an effective film mainly because it is very unnerving at times. It is disconcerting, and it is at times uncomfortable to watch. But the biggest problem I have is there's a certain casting thing that they do that is in a lot of ways unfair and doesn't work at all. But it needs to be that way for there to be any sort of big surprises. And, you know, it's an effectively done film, not perfect. And the acting's pretty decent. I mean, and you've got Emma Roberts in it playing one of the girl who's trying to come back from the mental hospital. And you got like James Remar and Lauren Holly playing this couple that are giving her a ride. So you see a couple recognizable faces throughout, but overall it's a very small film, and it's apparently directed by Norman Bates' own son, you know, Osgood Perkins, who's the son of Anthony Perkins. Apparently he's the director and the writer. It's getting some good buzz in sort of horror circles. Like I said, it's not this overt, in-your-face, gruesome body horror film, but it has some very genuinely creepy scenes and genuinely uncomfortable moments. And I have a good friend who said, even if it's not overtly scary, horror is there to make you feel uncomfortable. And if a film can do that, then to a certain degree, it's a success as a horror film. And I think that this movie does that. It like I said, it's very minimalistic. I mean, it's like a cast of like 10 people. So it is resting squarely on these girls' shoulders who are playing these stranded characters in limbo, because they don't know what's happened. Their parents basically haven't picked them up from the boarding school and they can't get in touch with them. So they just let them stay there over break. It's a winter break sometime in February. It definitely swerves into some creepy moments. Worth checking out, especially if you're a horror fan. Check it out on demand, or if you're in a good city that's showing it. The Black Coat's Daughter kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the big wide releases, The Boss Baby and Ghost in the Shell.
Thank you.
seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse, Kevin Carr's new novelettes Not the End and Gobble offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. It is time to talk about the big movies that are opening wide this week. The first one is The Boss Baby. Told from the perspective of a seven-year-old boy, the appearance of a new baby, out of a cab no less, makes the kid realize he does not have an ordinary brother.
We babies are having a crisis. Babies aren't getting as much love as we used to. Behold our mortal enemy, puppies.
Aww.
No! That's exactly the problem.
Who are you?
I'm on a mission. There's not enough love to go around. My job is to find out why. Now give me a double espresso and see if there's some place around here with decent sushi. I'd kill for a spicy tuna roll right about now.
Mom, Dad, the baby can talk.
This is war.
What's funny about this movie is it kind of existed somewhere under my radar. I really hadn't seen any ads. And my middle child, who's 13, came to me, and he's the one who's like, I want to see The Boss Baby, which is odd because usually, and I mean, unless it's like a big Pixar movie or something, usually my teenagers aren't bugging me to go see the film. And I remember watching the trailer and thinking, this thing's going to be garbage. This thing looks awful. Alec Baldwin as a baby. That's brilliant. I really had the lowest of the low expectations from this film. With that said, I then went and saw it on a Saturday morning, had to get up early, and it was, and that's the thing. That's one of the big problems with the kids movies. And this is the way it's going to be with the Smurfs next week when you hear me talk about it. You know, you have to get up in the morning on a Saturday and drag your sorry butt to a theater filled with kids to watch a movie. And for me, the way my weeks go, by the time the weekend rolls around, I'm just ready to just relax and stay at home and goof off. So having to get up and go on a Saturday morning, for example, to see a movie is not what I consider a fun thing to do. So a lot of strikes against this movie before it even rolls. I get in there and this movie starts. And you know what? I thought this movie was really kind of clever. And part of it's because it's told from this kid's point of view. He's like seven and he's an only child. And of course, he loves everything about being an only child. And at seven, that's actually kind of old for you to suddenly get a brother. I mean, most people pop out a second kid within the first 2 years, maybe 3 years. But if you're seven and suddenly you get a baby brother, it can be a challenge. And there's a certain level of spirit that you've seen in media like Calvin and Hobbes. And it's not as subversive or as edgy as Calvin and Hobbes is, but it has that feel because it does all come from the perspective of this seven-year-old. So there's some very hyper-real stuff, even in a cartoon. It bounces in and out of reality, and you really don't know whether this baby in a business suit is a real thing, or is it a dream, or is it just him applying his own insane seven-year-oldness on the situation. But it works. And actually, Alec Baldwin's quite funny in this. I think Alec Baldwin has a better career now, especially when it comes to comedy, than he did when he was kind of like the hunky male back in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, from Beetlejuice on and Married to the Mob. And he's hilarious in this. And it works even with this little kid, this adorable baby with the gruff Alec Baldwin voice coming out of it. And to the end, I enjoyed it. It has some very clever moments. It has some jokes in there. And this is key to animated films. It has some jokes that go completely over the kids' heads and smack the parents right in the face. And there's some jokes that borderline are like, oh, that's almost inappropriate, but it actually isn't inappropriate if you look at it from a kid's point of view. And there's some, like I said, just some very clever writing, some very innovative and cute jokes. And yeah, there's a deal with some poop jokes and fart jokes. Sure. But overall, I had a blast watching. I enjoyed the heck out of this movie. It surprised me. It was kind of like when Kung Fu Panda came out. I thought it was going to be the worst movie of the year, and I loved it. But yeah, no, I thought The Boss Baby rocked.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Ghost in the Shell. A woman with an enhanced cybernetic body tracks down a cyber terrorist while uncovering secrets about her own past.
You have to remember.
I saw someone down there. He wasn't human.
He's a known terrorist, and he's killed again.
They didn't just kill them. They hacked into their minds.
He's everywhere. Nowhere.
I will find him. And I will kill him.
You may have seen a little bit about this in the news because everyone's all upset that there's been whitewashing done on this character. It's based on originally it's a Japanese manga or a graphic novel. It's a certain type of graphic novel in Japan that was then made into a film, an anime film, back in the mid-90s, I think 1995. And it was one of those groundbreaking films. It was right up there with Akira as one of the best known, well-known animes that kind of really broke through to the American audience. Now, what's interesting is I just saw the anime again. I'd seen it long, long time ago, like 20 years ago, but I saw it again just recently because I got the Steelbook and it was neat to see, but there's so much in that movie that are sort of mundane. I mean, they're all talking about, cyber networks and everybody can hook up their brains to it and exist in this almost cyberspace, which was innovative back in 1995. It's kind of like, well, we've been there, done that, maybe not for full real effect, but the internet is pervasive all around the world. So the futuristic elements of the movie seem a little bit old if you go back to the original film. And the big difference in this is there's a huge cultural difference in how the movie is structured. The original film's very Japanese. It's very much for a Japanese audience. And it's all about tracking down, at the time they call him a hacker, I mean they call him a terrorist now because that's what's dangerous in 1995 versus 2017. And in the original movie, it's mostly just about her tracking him. This one, they put a lot about her identity and her past and who she was before. She doesn't remember, and she has sort of this history that she's talking to. And there's a real mystery behind all this that's not in the original movie. I mean, it may have been in the manga, but it's not in the original movie really at all. And that's a very cultural thing. I mean, now, you want to reach an American audience, you go for individual identity, and that's very important. And so there's a huge difference there. But here's the thing. You can't go in expecting a 100% faithful remake live action version of the 1995 version of Ghost in the Shell for several reasons. First of all, there's less of a human story in the original movie. They put more humanity in here. They make it tailored more for not just an American audience, but a global audience. But it's 22 years since Ghost in the Shell came out as a film before. So you have to update it. Now, there's been a lot of talk about whitewashing because they have Scarlett Johansson as the star in this. And of course, she's not Japanese. I remember back from the casting when the announcements came out, they're like, oh, Scarlett Johansson, it's whitewashing. And yeah, I mean, I guess it is. Here's the thing. I think some people just go a little bit crazy on the whitewashing thing because when they make this movie, with Scarlett Johansson, there's a specific economic reasons they went after Scarlett Johansson. She is a bona fide movie star. She is a bona fide action film star. And she has not just played in the Avengers movie. She has carried full blown action movies, science fiction movies on her own. Under the Skin, even though it wasn't a huge hit, it was a moderate independent hit, but even bigger, something like Lucy. Lucy would not have been Lucy without Scarlett Johansson. There was a lot of her that carried that movie. And the people like to watch Scarlett Johansson kicking butt. Is there an Asian actress that has the star level that Scarlett Johansson does? And yeah, okay, so when you import a movie from another country, and yeah, it has this sort of Asian-ish look to the sci-fi futuristic city, but so did Blade Runner, and so did The Fifth Element, and so did some of the Star Wars movies. The Asian influence on production design is not unique to this film. I don't think this had to be an Asian movie. It didn't. So first of all, there's entire countries that make movies with Asian people. This was made in America and it's made for a global audience and they're going for a global star. Scarlett Johansson certainly is a global star. I mean, like when you had Emma Stone as the whitewashed version of a Hawaiian in that awful movie by Cameron Crowe a couple years ago. Yeah, that was absurd. But this is a cybernetic body she's got. So with all that controversy aside, I actually kind of enjoyed it. I mean, like I said, it's not like the original. There's a lot of changes to it, although there are some scenes that are almost shot-by-shot remakes. But it's a visionary look at a cybernetic future. I enjoyed it. I thought the special effects were great, and you know, it had some good action scenes in it, and it did some neat stuff story-wise. So the heck with what everybody else says, I say that Ghost in the Shell kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be reviewing Land of Mine, talk about the weekly box office, and have the home cinema roundup. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Stop it now.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the final movie to review. I'm not going to actually play a trailer for it because it's a Danish movie. So let's talk a little bit about Land of Mine, which was nominated for Best Foreign Language Feature at the Oscars this year. And now lost to The Salesman. In the immediate aftermath of World War II, German prisoners of war, many of them just teenage boys, are forced to clear the minefields across Denmark. This is an odd, interesting pairing to a movie like The Zookeeper's Wife, because it's a World War II story, and this one has, you know, the German soldiers are the ones that are being put upon it. But the thing is, you also have to understand what was going on at the end of the war. The German military was just basically forcing a lot of the young men into combat. They were just doing it for love of country. They weren't like Nazis, really. They were just given us a weapon and thrown onto a battlefield. So there are a lot of very, very young men. I mean, like teenagers in the war. And then, of course, when finally at the very end of the war, you had a lot of them and they got captured. And in Denmark, which was occupied and, had no love for the Germans, they, of course, make the German POWs find the landmines. And it's a dangerous job. I mean, a lot of them lost limbs. A lot of them lost their lives, getting them blown up in their faces, because landmines are dangerous things. And it's very hard for anybody in America to understand this, because we've never had a war on our soil where people have put bombs in the ground all over the country. And I mean, I even remember back in the 80s, kids were running into landmines in European countries and getting blown up and losing limbs. And that was a big deal in Europe. It's not a big deal in America. But this is a challenging film because it makes you have to sympathize with the Germans, with the German kids that are doing this. And it's powerful and it's well done. It's well written and has a very slow burn to it. But you can understand what it's like being just shoved in the situation. Some of these guys were victims of circumstances and suffered greatly for it. And they weren't the ones running the war. I mean, they didn't have Hitler and Himmler and Goebbels on the field searching for landmines. Those, the people that were really responsible for the war, these are just the foot soldiers who were dragged into it because of geographically where they lived. So it shows where people will focus their rage, even if it's unnecessary. So Land of Mine is an eye-opening movie, very worth checking out. Land of Mine totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office real quick. Beauty and the Beast is a juggernaut. It made over $90 million last weekend, which is $15 million more than I said it would. Power Rangers did really well. Did about $10 million more than I said. It was over $40 million, which is fantastic. Life did 12.5, which is about on par with what they're expecting. And Chips kind of sunk with less than 8. There's nothing to me that says Beauty and the Beast isn't going to win again this weekend. I believe it's probably good for about $45 million. The Boss Baby's probably going to come up closest. That's going to be, I guess, $35 to $40 million. I mean, animated films are an easy sell. And even though you had Beauty and the Beast out there, in the Lego Batman movie's the last other kids movie, and the Power Rangers, I guess, as well. But I think Boss Baby, you know, for sort of like that end of spring break, beginning of spring break, right around Easter, this will be a big hit, I think, for DreamWorks. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The spotlight this week is going to be on Why Him, which is, of course, a comedy, came out at Christmas, stars James Franco and Bryan Cranston. And, of course, James Franco's dating Bryan Cranston's daughter. He's an internet billionaire, and Bryan Cranston is struggling with accepting him. I had a chance to talk to John Hamburg, who directed this film. He'd been also involved in the Meet the Parents. He helped write that and the Zoolander movies. So I had a chance to sit down and chat with him about Why Him. Let's just talk about where this story and the idea came from.
The producers, Sean Levy and Dan Levine, brought me a basic idea that they had been working on with Jonah Hill.
Okay.
And, you know, at that point, it was kind of the idea of a young, wealthy guy who dates someone's daughter and kind of the conflict between them. And that, Ian Helfer, my co-writer, and I ended up fleshing out that idea. It just spoke to us and to me, you know, as a way of kind of taking a classic theme, like a classic father of the bride, you know, meet the parents type theme, but exploring it from, you know, what's going on in the culture today.
Yeah.
Where all these young people suddenly find themselves, you know, wildly wealthy, didn't come up the traditional way, and people, you know, who came up and worked in corporations for years or built a solid business, you know, were sort of like, what's happening with the world? It felt very timely.
You mentioned Bryan Cranston. Is it intimidating to work with him? I mean, is he scary as all get out on set or not?
I didn't know him prior to making Why Him, and so I didn't know what to expect. You know, some of these movies I've been involved in, I've known the actors socially or I've done other projects with them. And I was, like everybody else, a huge Breaking Bad fan. But he's immediately disarming. And, you know, once you get to know him, he doesn't really bring the awards to set that often. You know, once in a while, he might, you know, you might just find the Emmy sitting on the director's chair just to kind of remind you, or the Emmys, just to remind you, you know, who's thought.
Let you know where you're sitting.
Exactly. but he doesn't do it that often. But I think he just dove into this comedy world head first. You know, he obviously had done so much comedy on TV and Malcolm in the Middle and other guest starring roles he'd done, but it'd been a while since he'd just done a pure comedy, and I think he really embraced it.
Yeah, you mentioned comedy, obviously. It's a comedy, and there's different levels of comedy in the film. You know, there's slapstick, there's situational. What do you like working on the most? I mean, of course, you have the stuff with James and Keegan running around doing their parkour.
Sure.
But you also have the more situational stuff with, like, Megan Mullally, who doesn't get enough work, in my opinion. I think it's great that she's in this movie.
Yeah.
What do you like working on the most? Do you like the broad slapsticky stuff or the more intimate character-driven?
No, for me, the more intimate character-driven material is the most fun. I mean, you know, there are physical moments in the movie, and obviously, as you mentioned, you know, with Keegan constantly assaulting James and evasive parkour, and that can be fun to shoot, but you shoot that, you know, in pieces, so it's not like you're discovering all of this comedy when you're doing that, but, you know, the little intimate moments, like Keegan coming into the bathroom and finding Bryan sitting on the toilet, it's quiet. There's not a ton going on, you know, and you can get a lot of mileage out of just two actors looking at each other, you know, in such an awkward setting.
Now, although this is R-rated, I wouldn't call this like totally extreme crazy. I mean, this didn't necessarily go gross out or crazy, but I mean, you had some pretty, some pretty daunting things. I mean, to go to like Bryan Cranston and say, hey, we're going to shoot you 3 days. You're going to be on a toilet. Do you have limits on comedy? Do you think there's stuff that's out of bounds or that you wouldn't ask an actor to do?
You know, I think of it more like, does it work for the story? Would the character find themselves in that situation? Mm-hmm. I never ask an actor to do something just because I think it will be funny. You know, it's always about the story, you know, because they could, if it's just there to be exploitative or push buttons, then they'll call me on it, and it's probably not something that should be in the movie. But, you know, I think they agree to do this stuff, and not only agree, but embrace it, because we spend so much time working on the story and the script and coming at it from a character standpoint.
I looked on Wikipedia because that's, of course, where you have to go for all your pertinent information.
Absolutely.
You're about my age. So I don't know if you have kids or a daughter or anything like that. I've got teenagers.
I did.
Who do you identify more with? Do you identify more with the parents in this movie or the kids? Because I think it's one of those movies that can work from either perspective.
That's a really interesting question, I think. I mean, I think part of the reason I wanted to do this movie was because I could actually see both sides of the coin. So I think I could see into both, but probably, even though I'm younger than Brian's character, I probably relate more to him.
Okay.
I wish I could be more like James's character, but I probably relate more to Brian.
If you want to hear the full interview, go to fatguysatthemovies.com and check it out. It's up there, and you can listen to me talk to John for a good 15 minutes, and we go into some more detail in the film, especially if you've seen it. You're going to get a little bit more of some of the things we talked about. Other ones this week are Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, the new Harry Potter series taking place in America, Patriots Day, which is, of course, Peter Berg's film. It stars Mark Wahlberg as a cop trying to track down the bombers in the Boston Marathon bombing. Silence, which was Martin Scorsese's film that kind of fizzled at award season, partly because they didn't show it to enough people, in which Adam Driver plays a Catholic missionary to Japan. Planet Earth 2, which is a BBC series. Gorgeous series. Always wonderful stuff from the BBC. Especially if you have an HD TV and a Blu-ray player, worth watching. 20th Century Women, which was another award season film. Got a little bit of buzz for Annette Bening. And then finally, A Monster Calls, starring my fantasy wife, Felicity Jones, as a woman who's dying of a disease and her son is coping with sort of this fantasy he's building in his own mind. That is it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Going in Style and Smurfs, The Lost Village. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.